Look up idiot in the dictionary. You know what you'll find?
A picture of me?
No! The definition of the word idiot, which you fucking are!
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to I Do Movies Badly, a podcast exploration of my cinematic ignorance. I'm your host, Jim Rohner, and despite being an amateur film critic since 2006, I am woefully ignorant of many films, filmmakers, and genres that consensus has deemed important, and thus I have created this podcast to document my journey into cinematic edification. This month, I'm exploring some films of the Universal Classic Monsters, as recommended by Gavin Mevious, and this week's episode, I'll be talking about the double feature of Dracula's Daughter and The Invisible Man. But before we get into that, I wanted to say a quick congratulations to David Bax and Tyler Smith at Battleship Retention for their 500th episode. I am not even up to 100 episodes yet, and I am absolutely boggled at the feat that 500 episodes entails, because if you're doing that every single week, sometimes more than every single week, I'll let you do the math. It's got to be close to, if not over, 10 years of podcasting. I was going to say podcast making. A better term would be podcasting. I've said this before to them in person. I don't know if I've said it on this podcast. Battleship Retention is my favorite film podcast that's out there. It was one of the first film podcasts that I started listening to, certainly laid down the early groundwork of my interest in podcasting and my doing my own podcast. And Tyler is a very good friend of mine and has been a mentor and a source of encouragement in regards to this continuing endeavor that is I Do Movies Badly. So a congratulations to both of them. They, of course, have both been on this podcast before. I love talking to both of them. They're both very knowledgeable, very insightful, and Tyler's not that big of a jerk. So congratulations to Battleship Retention on their 500th episode. This, of course, I Do Movies Badly is part of the Battleship Retention fleet. I am proud to be a part of that. Quite encouraged and proud that they considered my podcast to be worthy of inclusion amongst some other great podcasts that they have going on there. So yeah, congratulations once again. I've said that a bunch of times already, but congratulations once again to Tyler and David on this feat. I know if you haven't listened to Battleship Retention, please do that. Start listening to that immediately. It's a wonderful podcast. I think in the next couple months, it's going to be a little bit light on Tyler. I believe it's because of his academic necessities or obligations or priorities, I should say. So it's David's man in the fort and bringing on some guests in the meantime. But really, just pick an episode, go with it. Chances are it's going to be a good time. So and now into the discussion. I do want to say, first and foremost, I'm going to apologize to all of you because one of the movies that I am talking about in this episode, Dracula's Daughter, if you paid attention to my Facebook posts, it is difficult to find. And one of the things that I've tried to keep consistent, that I've tried to be very diligent about, is making sure that my guests are talking about titles which are going to be easy for you, the listener, to get a hold of if you haven't seen it and want to, or if, you know, you want a refresher, because, of course, I spoil a lot of things in the episode. I go into great detail about the movie, and so there is nothing safe. So I have to imagine if you're listening to this to these episodes, you have seen the movie before. But for whatever devices, if you want to go back and see it again or anything like that, you know, I try to make sure that the guests know or at least are aware of that so that it is easy to get a hold of. And that's not to blame anything on Gavin. I think it's just he was so very excited about this movie, and he had it readily available to him, so he talked about it. And then as I was actually sitting down or trying to sit down the other day to actually watch this movie, I was realized it's really not available streaming anywhere. In fact, I think if you are, at least for the American listeners, if you want to get a hold of Dracula's Daughter, I think really the only way that you can do it, aside from going to some perhaps shady streaming sites that I'm not going to recommend you do, is to get it on Netflix disc. And even then, you're going to get it on the double-sided disc of the Dracula's Legacy collection. So that kind of goes to show how difficult it is to get a hold of Dracula's Daughter. And so I do certainly apologize ahead of time for that, especially because of these two movies that I'm going to be talking about, Dracula's Daughter and The Invisible Man. I actually think that Dracula's Daughter is is the better one, is the more interesting one. And certainly, at least in terms of things that I want to talk about, points that I want to hit on, I have more, I pulled more from that, or I think at least the points that I can talk about are a little bit more intriguing than the ones that I can talk about with The Invisible Man. So it's going to be a little bit of a bummer, I suppose, that I'm going to be talking a whole lot about this film that you might not be able to get a hold of. So I do apologize for that. Gavin, apologize for it as well. I talked to him a little bit about it as he dropped the DVD off at work for me the other day, so I can get a hold of it. But hopefully that's not a big problem for you, because once again, if you're listening to this episode, I'm guessing that you've probably seen the movie already. So hopefully that won't be too much of a hindrance of your enjoyment of this episode. So with that, why don't we get into it? And I'm going to start with Dracula's Daughter because, at least in regards to my analysis, kind of theories that I had about it, and undercurrents or themes, whatever you want to call them, that I think can be explored, were a lot more prevalent to me in Dracula's Daughter, whereas Invisible Man, I'm going to go ahead and say that I think not that I was grasping at straws, but maybe I was filling in some gaps or kind of hoping that there was something there, whether or not James Whale intended it to be there, but nevertheless, I think there is a lot to say about Dracula's Daughter instead. So I think the first thing that stood out to me as being very interesting about Dracula's Daughter is this idea that Gavin and I talked about in the introductory episode, something that I mentioned in the past episode with Dracula and the Mummy, of this idea of things that really bug you about studios these days is nothing new. These, you know, habits of whether it's sequels or cashing in on pre-existing properties, or anything. This has been happening for a long, long time. And with Dracula's Daughter, it is this idea of a shared universe and a shared movie universe, because of course all of these titles are underneath the Universal banner, so of course they're going to share everything. But it goes at every level. Even, I mean, you think of some of the crew that's involved in Dracula's Daughter. You have two writers, you know, the credited writer at least. I can't even read my own handwriting that I wrote it down here now. I think it's supposed to say Garrett Fork, who was the screenwriter, and he had a credit in the past in the Dracula screenplay. You had I still can't read my own handwriting. John L. Balderston, who has a kind of a story credit or is sort of uncredited. He also had a hand in the Dracula screenplay, the Bride of Frankenstein screenplay. I think also some a hand in the Invisible Man screenplay as well, at least because. And we'll get into that in a little bit, but Invisible Man kind of was passed around to every writer in Universal's arsenal for until they eventually landed on the draft that they have. And John Fulton. John Fulton is a very important name as a visual effects guy, and once again, I'll talk about that more in The Invisible Man. But even on the back end, even in regards to people who are behind the scenes, they're showing up again. You know, they're recurring again, and it's this idea of trying to keep things consistent, or at least kind of going back to the crews that we had. And you're seeing this nowadays with at least Joss Whedon in the, you know, his initial involvement in the Avengers movies. Now the Russo brothers and sort of what they're doing in regards to starting with Captain America and then building out into the larger Infinity War, and then, you know, having Zack Snyder and Geoff Johns involved in the DC Marvel universe. So I mean, this may irk you that this is happening now, but this has been happening for a while. Get a little bit more specific, and that is some of the actors too who are involved in it. You have this guy named E.E. Clive, who I forget the role that he played in whether it was Dracula or the Mummy, but in this one he is a police officer, so he is certainly these are actors that are recurring. And Edward Von Sloan. Edward Von Sloan comes again because, if you recall, he was Van Helsing in Dracula, and then he was, I forget the name of him, but he was the essentially Van Helsing character in The Mummy. And that leads me to my next point, in the sense of it's sharing the same timeline, because once again, Edward Von Sloan is playing Van Helsing. Not only is he playing Van Helsing, he is playing Van Helsing who is be picked up immediately after the events of Dracula ended, in which he has driven a stake through Dracula's heart and killed him, which I find fascinating as well, that Dracula's Daughter is supposed to take place almost immediately after the events of Dracula ends, because you have Renfield, who is dead, who, you know, his neck broken or back broken at the bottom of the stairs. You have Van Helsing, who has been hammering the stake through Dracula's heart. And then for some reason, you have these police officers who stumble upon Dracula's, or Carfax Abbey, I should say. And despite the fact that Dracula took place in the you know, 19th century. This movie is taking place in the 1930s because there is an automobile, which, hey, you know, no one said it had to make sense, but at least, you know, there's that idea here. This is existing in the same universe. This is existing even in the same timeline. And I find that fascinating because, one of my favorite horror movies and favorite horror sequels is John Carpenter's Halloween 1 and then Halloween 2, who is, I believe, Nick Rosenthal is the name of the director. But I love that idea of a sequel taking place immediately after the first one has ended. So that's something that seemed like it was brand new when it happened in between Halloween 1 and Halloween 2, but apparently not. Apparently that was at least... 4 decades old that was happening. So once again, if you're complaining about what movie studios are doing these days with franchises and with properties, pre-existing properties, this is something that has been happening already. But Dracula's Daughter is very fascinating for a lot of other reasons, which isn't to say that those things that I mentioned make it not interesting. I actually did find that was pretty interesting because of that. But Dracula's Daughter immediately stands out to me because it's got it is a movie of strong female characters, and yes, you do have our main character, who is a male. You know, he's our protagonist. He's the one that kind of goes through the arc and goes through the journey of discovery about, you know, he's a skeptic at first, he is the believer at the end. But unlike Dracula and unlike the Mummy, in which our female characters are sort of seen as either just victims or objects of desire or obsession, in here they are characters with personality and with motivation, which isn't to say that they don't have, that they are not objects of desire and obsession in this movie, but they are not explicitly or strictly or only that. Starting, of course, with Count Zaleska, who is the titular Dracula's daughter, a female vampire who believes that now that Dracula is dead, by burning his body, she can be free of this curse that has made her into a vampire. And she is in a way, a very tragic character because she starts out very hopeful. She has this condition that she wants to cure, that she wants to be rid of. And yet, no matter what, despite the fact that Dracula is dead, despite the fact that she burns his body, she cannot free herself of this desire to bite, to feed, to satiate these vampire cravings within her. And she doesn't like it. She actively dislikes it, and she is desperate, and she wants to get a hold of it, which, of course, leads her into the arms, if you want to say that. I suppose you could say the figurative arms of our main character. And of course, I'm going to call it up now because our main character of Jeffrey Garth, of course. I figured I could only dance around not saying his name so often, so I had to look it up. But so her not wanting to be a vampire and her wanting to free herself leads her to Jeffrey Garth. But so there's a tragedy in her. There's a dimensionality to her, which is great. But then, of course, also, what I found delightful was Jeffrey Garth's assistant, the character of Janet, who, you see, at least what I saw was like, oh, okay, here's a movie in the 1930s, and this is a female assistant, so I'm sure she's going to be, you know, cast as kind of dumb. Garth is going to, you know, steamroll her, and instead, they're very much equals. In fact, there's a relationship that not only is pre-existing but develops into something more. You could make the argument that there's a romantic relationship that develops out of it, but the fact that Janet is She's a sassy character with a strong personality, and is really the only kind of person in this movie, with the exception of Zaleska, of course, who sort of stands up to Garth, and the one who kind of gives him shit. And, you know, there's an endearing sort of banter between them. You know, he gives it, and, you know, he gives it to her, and she takes it, but she gives it right back. And you see that from the very beginning, the scene where she pulls up in the car to the hunting trip, kind of, well, at least ruining the plans of Garth's hunting trip, because he is being called back as a psychiatrist to interview his old colleague and friend, Dr. Van Helsing. And he's very grumpy with her, and she just shoves it right back in his face. And it's wonderful because it adds an element of being able to relate to this character, of her being a fully fleshed character. And also, despite, you know, without having to get into the backstory between the two of them, you do immediately get the sense of a depth of their relationship, that they've known each other for a long time, that they've gotten to this point of bantering with each other because there is a level of comfort between the two of them, because they know so much about each other. I mean, friends are the ones who can needle you more than anyone, who can upset you more than anyone, because they know what makes you tick. They know what strings that they can pluck on to get you upset. And so it really seems like that there is has been a long pre-established relationship between these two, and so much so to the fact that Janet is sort of Garth's Achilles heel. You know, in order to lure him to Zaleska, in order to kind of ultimately achieve the goal that Zaleska feels she needs to achieve, she kidnaps Janet. She takes Janet prisoner because she knows that's Garth's vulnerability. And I love that. And I love that it's sort of, you have these three main characters, only one of whom is a male, and all of whom are very strong and three-dimensional and have a sense of depth to them. And that was really awesome. And it's also, and that kind of leads me into my next point about the sexuality in this movie. And this is I was surprised sort of how sexy of a movie this was, especially for, let me look, this is coming out in, 1936, and certainly there's no nudity, but there's enough dancing around it and implication of it and enough skin that I was actually kind of surprised that this was something that passed by the censors in 1936. They're like, yeah, this is fine. And I'm thinking specifically of the, let's just call a spade, the seduction scene of Lily. A young actress named Nan Gray, who is, I have to say, very easy on the eyes, who is a young girl that is lured into Zaleska's, let's say, lair, I suppose, under the assumption that she is going to be sketched or drawn or painted because Zaleska is an artist. And then it is a straight-up seduction sequence, even to the point of you never see Zaleska bite Lily. I mean, there is certainly, We may not have the other factor. We have 2 plus, blank equals 4, but we can figure out that 2 plus 2 equals 4, because after it cuts to black, we then have Lily in a gurney being wheeled into the hospital, and they make a big notion about how she has these two puncture wounds in her neck. So we it doesn't take a lot of work to put the pieces together to understand it, but the scene on the surface, or at least on a superficial level, what we have is a scene of a woman seducing another woman, and that woman being seduced is, at least for a 1930s movie, very scantily clad. And it's actually, I'm not rewriting the book here. I don't think I'm being revelatory when I talk about the lesbian undertones. Is it undertones or overtones? But the lesbian subtleties the lesbian stuff in this movie. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to be able to kind of figure it out and see that it's there. In fact, when this movie came out initially, the lesbian text was, it wasn't even subtext, it was lesbian text, and it was part of the marketing of, like, you know, no woman is safe, essentially, from Countess. I'm worried now that I've been calling her Count Zaleska, but Countess Zaleska, she was kind of labeled in the marketing material as a female who was a threat to other females. That's crazy to me that this was something that happened in the 1930s. And it's also interesting because if you think about Countess Zaleska, if you think about what brought her to Garth, if you think about her seeking out a psychiatrist for a specific condition, then it's not exactly a hop, skip, and a jump away. Or maybe it is a hop, skip, and a jump away. What I'm trying to say is it's not a far leap of faith to get from this idea of this woman who wants to cure herself of something so she sees a psychiatrist to this is an allusion to a woman who is struggling with and scared of her own homosexual desires. She talks about a condition she has. She talks about wanting to get rid of it. She talks about being desperate to be rid of it. And especially in the 1930s, the metaphor of a vampire and an outsider standing for the sexual outsider, the societal outsider, the homosexual, who in 1936 was certainly not widely accepted. And you think of the... I called back to the seduction scenes. I didn't call back, but if you recall what I said about the seduction scenes in Dracula, how he seemed very, if not asexual, then not specifically heterosexual, because his alluring, hypnotic, kind of seducive glare was the same for, male as well as female. Looked the same. Count Zaleska's hypnotic glare kind of seemed to stem from her ring, and that plot was not really explored too deeply. But despite the fact that, I think that Zaleska is sort of stands apart from Dracula because the seduction, at least she does seem to try and hypnotize Garth at some point in the movie, but, and she does even hypnotize a male on the street that she does bite, that he does become a victim. I believe he's the first victim in this movie, after, if you don't count Dracula. But the scene of hypnosis and of subduction, the one that we really see it kind of fleshed out and in great detail is when Zaleska seduces Lily. And it's not just the seduction, but it's also the physical skin exposure and the glaring looks of, and you know, the kind of, it sounds stupid to say two people lost in each other's eyes, that has a kind of a romance context to it, but the scene that has the really, or at least, I'm not doing a very good job of explaining myself here, but at least the scene that has that the seduction, which goes into the most into the greatest length, and which has the most visceral allure to it, is between Zaleska and another woman. And you could even make the argument, I suppose, that by kidnapping Janet at the end and by not biting her, by not killing her, Janet also becomes an object of desire. For Zaleska, and I think it's David Scull, the noted horror author David Scull. Gavin and I talked about it in the introductory episode. I think it's him, or someone who described the scene at the end when Zaleska is going to bite Janet and then doesn't because she's interrupted by the arrival of Garth and some other people. That scene is sort of described as the longest kiss that never was, because she's standing over her and she's kind of leaning in slowly and Janet's kind of there and she's out of it. And it does very seem, it has the machinations, at least the physical machinations, of a woman who's going in to kiss another woman. Of course, because she is a vampire, she's going to bite her. But it certainly has the setup of two people who are going to kiss. If, of course, Zaleska is actually a vampire. And now, this is one thing, this is my theory, this is not something that I find a base in anywhere. But I was wondering the whole time as to how much is the metaphor of Zaleska being a vampire standing in for her being a homosexual, how much is that supposed to be subtle, and how much is that supposed to be kind of explicit? Because, and I realize that there's not going to be perfect proof for this, but let me introduce this idea that Zaleska was not a vampire, that instead Zaleska was a homosexual, a self-loathing homosexual, and was using, or I should say, manifesting some other psychoses to kind of cope with or explain the fact that she couldn't reconcile that she was different from everybody else, that she had these desires within her that were not normal, quote-unquote, for society. And I think Gloria Holden's performance kind of plays into that, because Gloria Holden, according to the Internet Movie Database, Gloria Holden didn't really, kind of look down on this part, didn't really want to get typecast, because she had seen how the role of Dracula had sort of adversely affected Bela Lugosi, 5 years previously. So she kind of looked down upon this part, and there, that really kind of comes through in her performance, where it's this person who is, who kind of doesn't like herself, who is self-loathing, and so it kind of plays into that idea of our character being a self-loathing lesbian. But here's, I guess, the details why I think that, it might be a more explicit theme, if you will, in the sense that Zaleska never was a vampire. And I know that the big case against this is going to be, but both of her victims, the man, the random stranger she finds on the street, and Lily, both of them, it's very explicitly clear that they have two puncture wounds in their neck. Okay, I'll grant you that. There's no way that I can really argue or dance around that one. However, we never actually see her bite anybody, and granted, we didn't see Bela Lugosi do it either, but at least it was heavily implied. I mean, at least you had in at least with a scene with Lugosi, with Dracula and Renfield, he gets pretty close until that camera cuts to black. And sure, Zaleska gets pretty close to her victim as well before it cuts to black, but you never actually, but Exhibit A, you never see her actually bite anybody. Okay? Exhibit 2, she is not able to hypnotize her victims just with her eyes like Count Dracula's. Instead, she kind of requires some type of external object, her ring, in order to actually hypnotize people. Exhibit C, holy symbols, and granted there are no straight-up crucifixes in this movie, but certainly she has a cross made out of sticks or branches when she's burning Count Dracula's body, but it doesn't certainly seem like holy symbols or holy relics have an adverse effect on her like they do on Count Dracula. And for me, the big one is Exhibit D, in which her death is not at the result of a stake through the heart. Instead, she is shot with an arrow by her colleague or her former colleague, who very much wanted to be the immortal with her, who very much wanted to be the vampire victim so they could live, you know, in immortality together. But he is scorned. He's a scorned lover because she passes up him for Garth. And so he shoots with an arrow, but she's shot in the stomach. And I guess you could make the case for bad props or bad execution or bad special effects, except at the time of its release, this was the highest budgeted movie of these Universal horror movies. In fact, one of the reasons that the Universal monster movie cycle ended, at least the first cycle ended, was because, I don't know how you pronounce the name, but Carl Lemiel, Carl Lemiel Jr., had run some of these movies up over budget so much that they had to essentially kind of, you know, sell the rights or the company to someone else in order for them to keep going. So I don't think you can blame it on it being cheap or bad execution, especially considering 3 years earlier, the special effects that you saw in The Invisible Man, and once again, we're going to get to that. But I don't think you can blame it on lack of funds or lack of execution. So if we take that into consideration, then Countess Zaleska, is killed from an arrow to the stomach. And that's very unvampire-like. Sure, she sleeps in a coffin, but if you're so convinced, if you're so delusional that you're so convinced of this psychosis that you made up, you are going to support it by doing things like sleeping in coffins and not going out at night. Despite the fact that we never actually see any of those things that you'd think would adversely affect a vampire adversely affecting her. So I thought it was kind of fun watching this movie and kind of thinking like maybe she wasn't ever a vampire. Maybe she was so convinced that she was because she was an outsider, that a sexual outsider, that her brain started to sort of justify it or manifest this idea of, oh, well, there's something different inside of me. It must be because I'm a vampire, yes. And ignoring the fact that, no, you are just attracted to the same sex. And I found that to be very interesting. And once again, I totally understand if any of you think that this is bunk or bullshit or whatever. I don't think it's a strong case, but I like that idea. And if you watch this movie again, if you're able to watch it again, I'm sorry once again, watch it with that idea in mind that she is not actually a vampire and that she never was. I think it leads to an interesting rereading of the text of that movie. And so now let's get into The Invisible Man once again. As I did with the first, with the Mummy and the Dracula episode, I'll talk a little bit about both and then kind of bring them together and their similarities. And The Invisible Man surprised me because it's sort of more of a sci-fi film than it is a horror movie. There's certainly horrific parts to it. There's a lot of murder. There's a lot of violence. Some of it explicit, like when the policeman is beaten to death by Dr. Griffith when he is fully invisible. But The Invisible Man sort of kicks the trend of the movies that we have been watching, or the movies that I have been talking about, in the sense of, those had this idea of mythology versus science and sort of how science cannot explain what is going on, so we have to rely instead on the expertise of a character like Dr. Van Helsing, who is aware of the mythology, who is aware of where the vampire comes from or where the mummy, you know, comes from and how to combat that. We cannot do it with science. Science cannot explain that. So instead, let's rely on the figurative faith or spirituality or mythology. We have to rely on what is outside and unknowable in order to conquer what is unknowable. And the Invisible Man flips that on its head, because instead it is science which leads to the Invisible Man becoming invisible. They state it quite clearly. He was experimenting with whatever you want to call it, a potion, a serum, a concoction. He is experimenting with that, and he puts it and he ingests it in some way, and that is what turns him invisible. And that is also, at least in the movie versus the book, that is what turns him insane. It is science. It is pursuit of science. It is his hubris, and it is very much hubris because of the little speech he gives to his lady friend, is played by Gloria Stewart. Gloria Stewart, of course, playing old version of Rose in James Cameron's Titanic. And also, in this movie at least, has a very Gillian Anderson quality to her about it. Or I should say Gillian Anderson has a very Gloria Stewart quality about it. Either way, she's gorgeous in this movie. But in that speech that little conversation he has with her, he talks about that. He talks about how he wanted to pursue that potion, that formula, because he wanted to be famous. He wanted to be rich. He was a poor guy. You know, it was the pursuit of fame. It was the pursuit of something which caused him to lead to this. So it's very much rooted in something which is tangible and something which is maybe not necessarily outside of ourselves, but something that can be explained, something that can be explored, something that can be deconstructed and reconstructed. And that's what he's trying to do when he checks into that room, is he sets up his chemistry set, is he's trying to find a cure. He's trying to find a way for him to get back to being a visible person. And I found that interesting, because it really goes against the trend that we've been seeing in these previous Universal horror films, in the sense that it is no longer about what is outside ourselves. It is about us. And I'm sure there's something to be said about that. I've talked about it plenty of times with people trying to justify my love of the horror genre, of this idea that people are the scariest thing in this world. Because, yes, people are, with the exception of animals, people are sort of the only thing in this world. Plants, I guess, but I never really found that stuff too scary. But what is more horrifying than, you know, than pride, than having done this yourself? Hell, you know, in the novel of Frankenstein, it's all about that. It's all about man's hubris and pride, and, you know, the pride that it ultimately destroys you. So that is rooted in real life terror, but at least in regards to the context of the Universal horror movies, it's not really horror. It is sort of science fiction-y, or at least it's a science fiction entryway into a world which is horrifying to us. But having said that, the Invisible Man effects are fucking awesome. You know, especially considering they were done in 1933. And once again, John Fulton was the guy who was primarily responsible for the Invisible Man effects. I'm not going to say that they are perfect and that they are seamless. I'm thinking specifically of when our is he our protagonist? I guess when our Invisible Man, Dr. Jack Griffin, is at least terrorizing this small town. He is, I guess he's supposed to be riding a bike through the town, and at least on the version I was watching of this movie, the Blu-ray version, you can very clearly kind of see the strings along which the bike is, whether it's being pulled or whether it's a path on which it's going, you can see them. So it's not perfect, but I mean, the scenes of him, unwrapping himself in front of the terrified villagers, the scene of you know, them, of the kind of close-up of us looking through the eye holes to the back of the bandages, those are all, of course, because it's 1933, those are all practical effects. Those are all, like, things that are happening right there. And the method, you know, which was pretty cool, in which it was, the parts where he was unwrapping his head was, you know, his clawed reins was, you know, wrapped up in black velvet, and they shot it in front of a, you know, a black velvet curtain, and then also shot the other scenes and, you know, composed them on mats, which was kind of revolutionary. And John Fulton described that the most complicated shot was him unwrapping himself in the mirror, because there's actually four layers of compositing that has to be done there, four layers of kind of matte compositing that has to be done there. It's impressive. It's really impressive, and it's really kind of fun to watch. Especially, you know, as he is unwrapping, and also just kind of seeing the different ways and thinking of the different ways, like, okay, so how do they move this part, this book or this log or from here to here, or you know, it was really fascinating for me to kind of watch that and to kind of wonder how they did that, you know, sort of a peek behind the curtain or behind the scenes sort of stuff. And also, it raised I'm sure it raised some directing challenges for James Whale, because while Griffin is certainly wrapped up and, you know, and tangible to a certain degree for most of this, you know, in the sense that he's wearing clothes and his gloves and his head is wrapped up, there are parts, long extended parts, where he's completely invisible. And how do you have an invisible and talking to someone? You know, I'm thinking specifically of his first conversation with Kemp. And how do you... Well, you can't do it. You can't really do the standard sort of establishing shot, shot, reverse shot, when one of your characters is not there. You can't really do that. So you kind of have... So Whale has to sort of think of new ways to shoot a conversation between two people, because one of the people is not there. And a lot of ways that he sort of compensates for this is just to throw in more and more invisible effects of things moving on their own, seemingly. And I didn't really get bored of that. I kind of thought that I would be, but I guess maybe just be recognizing it, like, hey, it's a person talking to an empty chair. How can we make that interesting? Well, why don't we have the chair move? Why don't we have the chair look like it's indented? Why don't we have footprints appearing in the snow? And I found that fascinating. And so it still kind of carried the same gravitas or weight or emotional weight at the very least of two people having a conversation. And a lot of that has to do with Claude Rains. Claude Rains' work, because Claude Rains, for the most part, has to act with his voice through this movie, which was greatly upsetting to him, because he was a theater guy. He was known for having, you know, he was kind of known for his eyes and yes, his voice. And yet, when one of your defining characteristics is your eyes, and you're playing an invisible character who has to kind of wear sunglasses in order to cover up the fact that there is nothing behind your eye holes, I can see how that can be kind of frustrating. The only time you see Claude Rains' face is at the very end, when he is dead. So he has to carry that sense of menace, of craziness, and even at some points, maybe a little bit of sympathy. He kind of has to express all of that through his voice, because you don't see his facial features, you don't see his expressions, and there's only so much body language that you can have before it kind of becomes over dramatic and, you know, and kind of too expressive. Because while he came from a theater background, a movie is not theater. You don't need to be overly expressive, because the camera is in such a place where you can see what's going on directly in front of you. You're not seated in the very back row and have to squint and kind of wonder what is happening right now. There's a certain different dynamic in regards to the actor and audience relationship when it's film versus theater. So Claude Rains has to carry his entire character through the voice, and he does a fantastic job. Griffin is menacing, and sure, it's combined with the fact that if this were real, then, you know, he could be killing me and I wouldn't be able to defend myself because I couldn't see him. But he is always a threat, or there is always terror, or there is always tension, because of how arrogant he is and how vicious he is and how threatening he is. Kind of essentially telling Kemp, like, I'm going to kill you if you don't do this for me, and then kills him, and then still kills him. I mean, like I said, kills many people, and does it sort of gleefully, without a second thought, without consequence, and that is absolutely terrifying. So a lot of the effectiveness of this movie is because of Claude Rains. I think it's also, It's well directed, but I don't know. My biggest problem with The Invisible Man is that I'm getting kind of spoiled now on these idea of these movies, which sort of, if they don't follow a specific three-act structure, they at least follow this idea of, here's an introduction to the world, here's our characters, here's the changes that they're going through, and sort of here's a resolution. And The Invisible Man screenplay feels a little bit rough, because it doesn't seem to have an arc so much as it's just sort of a sequence of events that happen one after the other. I mean, when we start this movie, Griffin is already insane. He's already been invisible for a while. He's already well been driven mad. And we don't get a whole lot of what was he like before this wasn't the case. And is there any hope for him, you know, not being that? It was difficult for me to identify a protagonist in this movie, or someone who kind of goes through a change, who is our audience surrogate supposed to be, who is the one who's supposed to introduce us into this world, because it would seem like it's
Claude Rains. It would seem like it's Jack Griffin, because he is the first main character that we see. He is the one, you know, that we are first introduced to, with the exception of some villagers, when he's checking into this inn or this pub or whatever it is. And you know, so he's our introduction to the story, and he's the one that sort of introduces this idea of, here's the problem, here are the stakes, here's what I'm trying to do, here's what has to happen. But then we assume maybe it's supposed to be Kemp, because Kemp is sort of the normal guy. Maybe he's going to be the one who is going to be exposed to Griffin, his old colleague, and he's going to be the one who is going to try and who's going to overcome this adversity. But no, instead Kemp gets killed. So it can't be Kemp who is our protagonist, and it can't be Flora, Gloria Stewart's character, because she's in there barely. She's kind of just like there as a supporting character, and it can't really be Dr. Cranley, because Dr. Cranley is played by Henry Travers, who you may know as Clarence from It's a Wonderful Life. But it can't be Dr. Cranley, because Dr. Cranley is essentially kind of there as like a voice of exposition to kind of set up and kind of let you know, oh, here's how he developed this serum potion, whatever. Here's how we found out about it, and sort of here's the effect it had on him. And it's rough that there's no kind of character to follow or to root for. It's just sort of a series of events which are happening. We're sort of, you know, we're just sort of kind of watching Griffin go about his whatever it is he wants to do, his killing spree. I guess he wants to kill people and rob banks, but then he wants to share all the money with people. I mean, Gavin talked to me and was kind of describing it as someone had described his character sort of Heath Ledger's the Joker, in the sense of he just wants to be a part of and just wants to be chaos. And that is interesting for a supporting character, for a villain, for a side character, but that is not the kind of character that we want as a main character. And even if he is supposed to be the main character, I mean, what is there that we're supposed to relate to? What is it that we're supposed to empathize with? I guess it's supposed to be the fact that, you know, he is at the point that he's at of some, at least initial noble aspiration, or if it's not noble, then something that we can get on board with, that we can understand. He wanted to be rich. He wanted to get out of poverty. He wanted to make a name for himself. He wanted to be able to provide for the woman he loves. But instead he became a madman. And when we're introduced to him initially, he is a madman. He's a madman through this entire movie until he kind of is dead. And I'm not really sure what to do with that or make of that. So instead I would just kind of have to sit back and enjoy the practical invisible man effects instead. Speaking of man, this movie is called The Invisible Man, and I think one thing that I also think is interesting that James Whale adds to this, and I'm not entirely sure, honestly, what to do with this, but there seems to be sort of a subversion of what we know of as the archetypical man. And I wonder how much that has to do with James Whale being the outsider, being the gay male director making this, and what he was sort of trying to do with that. Because you have, and I'm thinking of three characters specifically, three characters who, when initially introduced, are sort of what we would think of as the quintessential or archetypical man, especially in a movie. You have the bartender in the little, whether it's an inn or pub or whatever it's supposed to be, but you have the bartender who in movies is sort of like an authoritative figure. You know, he can throw people out, he can refuse to serve people drinks. He's supposed to be sort of the one who is in command of his establishment and of his space. And then you have Kemp, who is, it seems like he's very clearly infatuated with Flora. He wants to be the one to provide for her, or at least he wants to be to be the object of her affection, and he wants to be the object of her desire, and he wants to kind of supplant Griffin as that. He wants to be the man in charge. And then of course you have Griffin, who is in many regards the man in charge. He is he's the intelligent one. He's the one who discovered this formula. He is the one who is sort of driving this movie forward in a way. You know, he is the one that has the goals, and he is the one that is active in trying to achieve what he wants. And yet all these men, too, also have things which subvert that about them, or at least, if not cancel those things out, those quintessential male things about them, then at least reveal them to be not the man that we thought they were. The bartender, despite being the bartender, is very much sort of emasculated by his wife. His wife is very much the one who's in charge. The wife is very much the one who wears the pants in that relationship. He tries to stand up to Jack Griffin by throwing him out, but he is very much at the command of his wife. He cannot stand up to his wife. So we have a guy who should be an authoritative figure, but instead is sort of emasculated. Then let's get to Kemp, the man who is, you know, comes across, at least when we first see him, as what seems like he's going to be a tough guy. And yet, near the end, near the end of his life, you know, after his exposure to Griffin, after Griffin kind of takes charge of it, he becomes sort of blubbering and paranoid and kind of schizophrenic in a way. You know, he is a man who is not in control of his emotions. He is a man that reveals himself to be cowardly in a way. He does not, and yeah, I'll grant you, Jack Griffin is invisible, but he is a man who doesn't really stand up to Jack Griffin, is afraid of Jack Griffin, is a man who, even if introduced as a manly man, is one who does not come through with that, who in a way kind of goes down without a fight in a way. And so we kind of have that kind of, you know, undercutting and subverting that too. And then, of course, Jack Griffin, the Invisible Man, is just mentally unstable and is an egomaniac and is a, whatever you want to call him, I think psychopath would be a better descriptor than sociopath. But you have a man who, yes, he is intelligent and he is driven and he is ambitious, but he is also mentally unstable. And so you sort of have this subversion of what should be the manly men or the manly archetypes. And I don't know if that was intentional, but that was something that stood out to me, and I can't think that it's a coincidence considering who James Whale was and also what James Whale had done previously and would do afterward with the Frankenstein character, especially in Bride of Frankenstein. And so I guess that sort of leads me into my next part of what are the similarities between these two movies. And I think the similarities have to do with people who are dealing with a sexual repression in a way. And despite the fact that I talked a great deal in the last episode about what the individual viewer pulls out of a movie, what the individual viewer sees in a movie and what adds relevance to them, I will also concede that with this next theory that I have about the Invisible Man, it's not something that so much stood out to me as much as I'll be honest, I kind of went searching for it. I kind of had, I guess you could say, an agenda, or I was kind of hoping to find something which would support this theory that I had of, because it's James Whale, he was probably doing something that was alluding to the outsider or being different, and specifically being different sexually. So I kind of, in a way, I kind of brought a frame to this movie and was hoping that the movie would fit within the frame, and sort of saying, instead of sort of, you know, kind of finding a picture and then framing something on it to make sense of it afterwards. I was kind of looking for something in a way, which is, I guess, a little bit dishonest. But I don't know. I don't know what more to say about it except, yeah, I think The Invisible Man is about a man who is repressed sexually in some way. And I was looking for ways to kind of tie that into maybe he is a man who is has suppressed his homosexual tendencies. I didn't see a lot of that in there, or at least the things that I found to support that idea were also kind of derogatory or negative towards homosexuality. At least if you think of his kind of being free, his kind of unbandaging himself and kind of being out and open, because what are the bands other than sort of a figure of constriction and a figure of form instead of, you know, and something which kind of does limit him from being the man who he or the object that he wants to be. But if you look at him kind of unraveling himself, kind of, you know, a form of coming out, if you want to see that as a man who is being open about his homosexual inclinations, I can't see that as being anything other than negative, because when he is out of those wrappings, what is he doing? He is robbing, he is murdering, he is free to be the psycho that he wanted to be. And I just can't see James Whale as kind of making that point as a homosexual and also as a very progressive thinker and filmmaker. I just can't see him making that point. So instead, the way that I made sense of it was, this is just a man who was sexually repressed, who could not be with the woman he loved, who could not come through and on the relationship with the woman he loved. And perhaps you could fill in him being poor and impoverished as, you know, as maybe something, as being inadequate sexually. But when he is unwrapped and when he is unraveled, when he comes out, you know, it's sort of him being free from this repression. He can do whatever he wants. And the idea of doing whatever you want, of the pendulum swing in the opposite direction of repression, that's something that is not necessarily positive, that can be destructive, that can be negative. So I can see that as making sense, of this idea of breaking free of sexual repression and just having no boundaries and having no barriers like Jack Griffin did, because he does not have those physical boundaries and those physical barriers, despite the fact that he's not immaterial. But for us as a viewer, he could be anywhere, he could be everywhere for all we know. If you look at that as being not just free of sexual oppression, but kind of bursting free out of it, I can kind of see that as being a negative thing. And once again, I fully admit I'm probably grasping at straws with that one. It's not a fully formed theory, or at least in my head, whether there's substance or not, it's not as fully formed as the theory that Zaleska was never a vampire to begin with. And it's certainly not nearly as substantial and as confirmed as, yes, Zaleska is a lesbian, and there's very much a theme there of dealing with repressed homosexual feelings. That theory is, as at least taken from The Invisible Man, is not nearly as strong. But I was looking for something, and I guess maybe it's because I was, outside of some directorial flares, a little bit obsessed with upset with The Invisible Man as a story, that I was kind of hoping or looking for something which would make it resonate more, or make it more progressive, or make it stand out more. I was looking for something that would do that. And maybe I needed to see that there in order for me to appreciate the movie more. But that, once again, I fully admit that doesn't necessarily mean that it was there. But I would certainly, of course, be fascinated as to your interpretation, as to your analyses. What could The Invisible Man stand for as a metaphor, as an allusion to something else? What do you think it could be? That's something I am very, really, really curious to hear. Something that I didn't do a whole lot of research or reading into. But I'm very curious to hear about that. So I will get into the availability of the movie, but that I want to hear that from you. Email me at youdomoviesbadly@gmail.com, or leave a comment like Fiction Isn't Real did on battleshippretension.com in the comments field. Leave your thoughts there, or leave your thoughts on the Facebook page, facebook.com/idomoviesbadly. I do want to hear from people about this. I really, really do. But now, as for the availability of The Invisible Man, much easier to get a hold of than Dracula's Daughter. Although, of course, I suppose that even just one streaming service would be easier than Dracula's Daughter. But rental or purchase, easy enough to get on Amazon, on Vudu, or on Google Play. Also the Microsoft Store, if you are an Xbox user. But that's how you can get your hands on The Invisible Man. And that brings us to the end of this double feature of Dracula's Daughter and The Invisible Man. Yeah, I am not as confident in my readings and my analyses of these movies as I was with the other two. That's why I do this show, to kind of to openly muse on these things and hopefully get some feedback and engage in dialogue with people. So of course I always want to hear from you, and I of course just have left some ways in which for you to do that. So yeah, that does it for the end of this double feature, which means that next week it's a little bit sad. It's the last double feature of the month, which also means that pretty soon Halloween season is going to be over, and then it's on to November, where some of us will focus on the Thanksgiving holiday season, and some of us will go straight to looking forward to Christmas. But yeah, next week, of course, I am wrapping it up with two versions of the Phantom of the Opera, the silent film from the 1920s, and the color talkie film version from the 1940s. So be sure to tune in next week, where I'll be going over the Phantom of the Opera double feature, and where I will be wrapping up Universal Classic Monster movies, and where I'll be wrapping up the Halloween times, unfortunately, and where hopefully I will be just a little bit less ignorant.
This program is a proud member of the battleship Pretension Fleet.